We're in lesson number 10. Lesson number 10 of the book of Numbers. Last week, we ended chapter 19. It was really a milestone when we did end chapter 19. It was basically the end of 2 years since the nation of Israel had left Egypt. They had gone to Mount Sinai. They had built the tabernacle complex. They had ordained and anointed everything, including the priest. They had left and they had headed out to Kadesh Barnea. They'd gotten to Kadesh. They'd sent the spies north. They had brought back the huge cluster of grapes. They also brought back the report, and the congregation rejected the report. And lo and behold, the Lord decided that it was time for them to head back to Mount Sinai. For 38 more years, they landed back in Mount Sinai within just a couple of months from the time they left Kadesh Barnea. There they had some more issues with rebellious people in the congregation. And then the chapter of 19 ended. And as we open up with chapter 20, we are 38 years later. Now, we don't know if it's actually where we are in the, as we pick up chapter 20, we're not really quite sure. We know we're in the first month, but is it the first month at the end of the 39th year, you know, the first month of the 40th year? Or is it the first month after the 40 years have passed? In other words, is it the 41st year? We don't know which year it is. In fact, we have a difficult time figuring that out, and we will not know that ever until we all get to heaven. We'll know it when we get to heaven, but we don't know it now. We will know that that the time from leaving Egypt on the Exodus until Solomon begins building the tabernacle in his fourth year as king is 480 years. We know that for a fact. So we've got the timer there to keep us on track. But what's happening right here, we don't know exactly. Is this the first month of the 40th year? Is this the first month after the 40th year? We're not quite sure. We pick that up and we find that here in chapter 20, verse 1a, where it says, "The sons of Israel, the whole congregation, came to the wilderness of Zin in the first month, and the people stayed at Kadesh." And if you look down in that map that I have there on the first page of your lesson, you'll see that from Mount Sinai to Kadesh, Kadesh is right on the border of the Canaan land, Egypt. It's also right on the border between the wilderness of Zin and the wilderness of Paran. If you look here on the board, I've drawn, this is not a really good to scale map. The more I look at it, the worse it is. But here's the wilderness of Zin. Here's the wilderness of Paran. This is all called the Negev. In fact, the Negev goes all the way down even lower into the peninsula here. But it's all this desert area. And here is this area of land that is going to be controlled by the Edomites. But right now, and the Edomites are not Canaanites, but there are Canaanites living in the wilderness of Zin. We're going to get to them before the end of the lesson and talk about them. But they're right, the nation of Israel is right here at Kadesh. This is the same place that they refused to go into the promised land from 38 years before. It's 247 miles from Mount Sinai by the well-worn trade route up to Kadesh. Now, something that's not on the board, and I'm gonna put it on the board real quick. There is a trade route that follows the red line that I just put on the board that goes by the edge of the Mediterranean Sea, or what they called at that point in time, the Great Sea. Mediterranean was not the word for it. It was called the Great Sea. If you'll notice kind of here on the map, and also that I have for you, which is a better map, and you see where Kadesh is up on the board, the nation of Israel is real close to that major trade route. Real close. We're talking from Kadesh, we're talking 20 miles at the most from hitting the major trail, turning to the west, And by the time it would take them to get from here to Huntsville, they're back in the land of Goshen. So in other words, they're 5 days, 6 days, maybe a week at the most from Kadesh to being back in Egypt. They're not far away. So they've landed here in the very first month. Now, when they left and they went to travel the 247 miles, I want to put that into a little bit of perspective for you. We have now, we don't know the number of how many men there are 20 years of age and older who are able to be in the army, but that will come because they're fixing the number and make a census pretty soon. Because remember, we've got a whole new generation here. We're 38 years down the road from the last verse of chapter 19. In the last verse of chapter 19, there's about 550, maybe 560,000 men left in the army who have not died because the Lord's taken their life because of their rebellion, plus all the women and children. But everybody over the age of 20 is going to die at Mount Sinai and be buried in the sand. And now we're 38 years later. So that means everybody who was 19 years of age and younger are now 38 years older. You follow me? So 38 and at least 19 means the oldest person there at Kadesh of the normal congregation and of the Levites that are that extra tribe that's given to the priest to do their work, well, 38 and 19 is, what's that, 57? Huh? It's 57, I believe. 57, okay? So somewhere between 57, 59, something like that. And I also want you to think about this. You know, I think of things as I'm studying sometimes that most normal people, you have to just run through these scriptures and you don't back up and see what it's actually telling us because of it's laying out the timeline here. Think about this. There were people who were born and were 2 years old that had been born out there in the wilderness at Mount Sinai or somewhere on the trail who never were in Egypt and are now 38 years older. They are 41, 42. You've also got all those children who were born in that 38-year time. And you've got all these men who are over the age of 20 who are now the army. We're going to find out it's over 600,000 when they finally take the next census. So the nation of Israel has actually become greater than it was whenever the Lord sent them back 38 years before because so many of them died at being rebellion that the Lord has brought them back greater than they were at the time that he made that statement to Moses that I'm going to make you a greater nation than you are right now. And so when we think about that, we've got a nation here where, you know, even if you were 19 years of age when you left Egypt, okay, I believe at 19 you probably remembered the hardship of Egypt because you probably went to work at 13 or 14 or something like that, if you were a male to work in the service of the king to help the Pharaoh to help build his stuff. But let's say you were 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 years of age in Egypt, you probably did not remember a lot about Egypt. And what you did remember about Egypt was probably the good parts because you know how time is on us. We always talk about the good old days. Well, folks, the good old days, I got news for you, were not always the good old days. Not always. Now, I will tell you this, when you were younger and you could run and jump and play and all that, and now you're bent over, yeah, that probably was the good old days. You know something about bending over? We think about people getting down in their back and bending over. like this. But you realize that's not the back bending. That's your legs bending. Did you realize that? Did you know that back in the 16th century and 15th and 14th, the word leg actually meant the jointed bones, and it came from the Latin for jointed bones, and it actually meant both your upper limbs and your lower limbs. Do you know what they called your legs when the King James interpretation was put into place, what the common name for your legs were? The strong men. That's what the English called them, the strong men, because they're the strongest part of the human body, the strong ish. The man means ish, but it's the jointed ones, the ones that has joints that cause you to bow down. You don't bow with your back, you bow with your legs. Isn't that interesting? Just hang around. I'll give you more of that sometime. The etymology of words and how they come through. Well, there's not a lot of old people, really old, there, 58, whatever, except for we still have Moses. We still have Miriam. We still have Aaron. We have Eleazar. We have Ithamar, Aaron's two priestly sons. We have Joshua, who was not 20, 38 years earlier. He was 19 or a little younger than that. We have Caleb. Caleb's going to get to go in the promised land. And he was 40-something. I think he was 41 whenever he got to go and be a spy. So he's going to get to go. So he's there. And so all these people have ended up there in Kadesh to go up into the promised land. And the Lord has taken them right back to where they sinned the worst that caused them to go back to Mount Sinai. All they're doing is picking up right where they left off, where they should have made a right decision 38 years before. You ever been there in your life? You ever been? We're not even the first verse here, and I'm already preaching to you. Left the Bible teaching and gone to the preaching. Gone to meddling, in other words, as we call preaching. Where you left the Lord standing there or sitting there someplace, and you went and did your own stuff. And then, when you finally needed to find the Lord, where did you go back to? The last place you remembered that you left him. And you go back for the second chance. That's right. Because you're so stupid in your theology that you don't realize the Lord has been right with you wherever you've gone. And all you have to do. But you think in the human way we think, we got to get back to the Lord. As if he's over there and you're over here. But the Israelites were that way, and Moses picked them up, and the cloud led them back. Because they're gonna need to go back into the promised land, and that's where the Lord wanted to launch them from. So we look on down into verse 1b. They were at Kadesh. Now Miriam died there and was buried there. Well, what a happy reunion in Kadesh. Miriam, the mother of the whole nation of Israel in some form or fashion. Moses' sister. Now I want you to look down on the next page, and there is the classic public domain picture from 120 years before Miriam dies, at least. It's 120 years before. Remember, Moses was born in Egypt, lived there for 40 years, left there for 40 years, went and got them out of Egypt, and was leading them for 40 years. 40, 40, and 40, any way you look at it, is 120. They're at Kadesh Barnea now, and Moses is 120. His older brother, Aaron, is 3 years older than he is. He is 123. And Miriam, who is the oldest sister, older than Aaron, is much older than Moses. And in fact, this picture is very interesting because the artist knew enough to know that she was much older. Now, we covered this when we covered this in Exodus. How much older was Miriam than Moses? We do not know. But because of the conversation that she had with Pharaoh's daughter about Moses, she had to be six, at least. But even with that, when you break it down, eight would be a better number. But better than that, probably Miriam being a 12-year-old might be a better number. A girl old enough to be accepted by a Pharaoh's daughter to know what she's talking about when she said to Moses, that was her name, "Do you, would you like to see if I can find someone that can nurse this brand new baby for you that you could hire?" And the daughter says yes. And Miriam goes and gets Moses' mother and brings. Can you imagine the joy of putting your baby in a little wicker basket that's been covered with pitch tar, and you put some sort of covering in there to keep the tar off the baby, and you put that baby over into the bulrushes and hope something causes that baby to cry when the Pharaoh's daughter and the entourage comes down to take their regular baths every day at the edge of the Nile River. That baby, Jochebed, was not a stupid woman. She put that baby right where she knew that the rulers of the world, the females, would come to take their baths. And then Miriam is old enough to make the negotiation, used by the Lord in a mighty way. But I want to tell you, that's the good part about that story. Miriam is probably 130, maybe less, maybe a little more when she dies. But we look at the picture, and I want to show you something that's kind of tragic. First of all, look at the face of Miriam in the picture. She has Egyptian makeup on. Now, I realize she's a teenager, but they were Hebrew slaves. I don't think that things were like they are today, back with the Hebrew slaves in those days, where teenagers could hide behind the thing of the day, whether the family had money for it or not. So the makeup's wrong. Look at the clothing also. It is wrong too. That is not the clothing of an Egyptian, of a Hebrew child. That is the clothing of a Hebrew child. I mean, of an Egyptian child or young lady. First of all, because you see how pure, clean, and white it is. Well, we're not even going to come into the turn of the 1900s with pure, white, clean clothes. The most expensive clothes you're going to be able to buy at the turn of the 1900s is going to be a dingy white instead of a pure white. If you could afford a pure white shirt, you had money. If you could afford reds, which were the most expensive, and the purples and that in material, you had money. These were slaves. They didn't have money. And Moses there in that little basket looks like he's about ready to tip it over. That's a chunky little baby, isn't it? With white on him. It's a beautiful picture, but it's not the picture of what slaves would look like, putting a child out into a basket. I wish the top was on the basket, because remember, the daughter of Pharaoh has to open it up and says, "Why? It's a Hebrew child." How did she know it was a Hebrew child? Because the skin color of the Pharaohs and of the Hebrew children were almost exactly the same. How would she know? By the clothing and the wrap that it was in. She knew by the style of what the Hebrews had wove that mother put that child in. So Moses is there. She is picked up. 120 years later, we now have Miriam dying at Kadesh, right where she was 38 years before, and they bury her there at Kadesh. Verse 2. There was no water for the congregation, and they assembled themselves against Moses and Aaron. What is new? What is new? Unbelievable. They're just fine with Moses and Aaron as long as they're at Mount Sinai. We hear nothing about what's going on with the children of Israel between chapter 19 and chapter 20. Between getting back and realizing, yes, Moses, you're in charge, and then getting back out on the road. Remember what happened just a few chapters before? They're fine at Mount Sinai. They've got everything done. But as soon as they hit the road, 3 days later, what they're doing? They're grumbling and complaining. Sure enough, here they are. They are probably 7 days, 8 days, 9 days, 10, no, 30 days out of their 30 days. It's 247 miles. So if they traveled 10 miles per day, then they were able to get and took off for every Sabbath day so that they didn't go any place on the Sabbath. They're 30 days down the road. So that means they could have left on the first day of the first month and arrived by the last day of the first month. So they're all doing it within the first month. It's fine. If they went a little faster than 10 miles per day, then they got there earlier. What is interesting about that is, I have to pause, and here's another thing that I'm realizing. I'm not realizing, I think I can prove it in the scripture. What did they do at the tabernacle complex every day when they were on the road? Did it stay packed? What happened to their morning required sacrifices? What happened to their evening required sacrifices? Did they just say, oh, we're following the cloud. Oh, we don't feel like putting the thing back up. We'll just skip that this morning, or we'll skip that this afternoon while we're on the road. God will surely understand. He'll understand. No, I don't think he would, because he had given instruction for required morning sacrifices and evening sacrifices, Sabbath sacrifices, and there had to be the new moon, the first day of the month, for the monthly sacrifices in there somewhere. And you think, how did they do that? Well, let me bring it into perspective for you. Back when Harvey hit, we actually videotaped the loading and unloading of 53-foot 18-wheeler trailers. And we have one video that is on social media right now, and it goes in stop time, fast forward, okay? But it's 18 minutes long. In 18 minutes, 18 men unloaded an 18-wheeler that was filled to the top, and nothing was on pallets, and they did it in 18 minutes. In 18 minutes, they came in with pallets, with boxes, repacked everything, and unloaded the 18-wheeler, and then another 18-wheeler came in. So that caused me to back up and think, well, while down in Danbury, when we were working in Danbury, we had an 18-wheeler coming in, and lo and behold, in 45 minutes, about 30 of us down there, and we were old men. These were young men in Harvey. We were old men back then. We unloaded the 18-wheeler with all the stuff that was coming in, and I got to thinking, huh? Well, 38 years before, there were 22,000 Levites who were set aside to be the helpers with Aaron and Ithamar and Eleazar to move the tabernacle complex for all practical purposes. Well, these chairs that you're sitting in came in two 18-wheelers, 10 chairs to a stack, plastic wrapped on cardboard box bottoms, nothing on pallets. We had to drag them to the end of the truck, cut them open, hand them off one by one. We had 451 volunteers, and we unloaded over 2,000 chairs in less than 40 minutes and put them in the rooms where they are now. So I'm thinking, 22,000 Levites. Now, we're 38 years later. I don't know how many Levites are there now, but surely there's about the same amount. All the old Levites have died. I mean, all those who are over 20, and they were all over 20 because they had to be over 30 and older to be in the service of helping the priest. So now we got a whole new crop. Oh, by the way, Aaron, Ithamar, and Eleazar had to go inside the Holy of Holies and inside the holy place and pack the furniture before the Levites could really do anything. So it's the Ark of the Covenant, it's the menorah, it's the table of showbread, it's the table altar of incense. Four pieces of furniture, plus its utensils and the fire pans and all that type of stuff, that all had to be packed. So Aaron, Eleazar, and Ithamar went in, took down the veil, threw it over the Ark of the Covenant, wrapped it, stuck the poles in, put the waterproof tarp on it, packed the menorah, packed the altar of incense, altar of showbread, altar of incense, and then packed the showbread, and said, "All right, Kohaths, come get them." And the next thing that happens is the Gershonites and the Merarites just hit it like a bunch of ants. And down it comes. Termites, okay. No, they're Levites, they're not termites. Merarites, not, okay. They move, and it comes time to set up. Do you realize that the hardest thing about putting up and taking down a tabernacle complex or anything is building it the first time and taking it down the first time? Do you realize that? If our automakers can make our new cars that cost $70,000, $80,000, and they're all plastic, almost, in 9 minutes, have you seen that? Think about your Chevy Tahoe that starts on one end, and 9 minutes later, it's finished on the other end. And goes out. Well, if you and I were to decide to take that Chevy Tahoe apart, number one, it would take us days. Now, you realize when they put those things together, they put them together in big chunks. You know, the engine's all together, and they just have to hook a few holes. It's not, okay. But if we went to do that, number one, we wouldn't remember where things came from. Number two is, it'd take us a whole lot longer to put it back together. But listen, they're doing this temple complex, and let me put that in perspective. The tabernacle tent with the Holy of Holies and the holy place was about the size of this room that we're in right now. And you have 22,000 Levites to help get it down. You talking about running over, and stepping on, yes, there's boards, there's sockets, all that type of stuff that has to be packed up and has to be unpacked and put back up. And then you've got 275-foot curtains that are running down the outside of the complex and 87.5 feet long curtains running across the narrow parts. All those curtains come apart. Levites are working in teams. You catching my drift here? Yeah, you're catching my drift. Yes, sir, Tom.
So Henry Ford was not the first inventor of the assembly line.
He wasn't?
No,
evidently that's a good idea. That's probably right. But what I'm trying to say to you is I believe that it was time to move out. Aaron, Ithamar, and Eleazar went in and packed the four pieces of furniture with the fire pots and the pans and the utensils. And then they got out of the way. And probably in 30 minutes at the most, it was down. And it was on its way. And if you remember, it followed out. The furniture went after Judah, if you remember. We saw that in one of our lessons. And then the two tribes. And then as the next tribe, the fourth tribe, before the fourth tribe came in, here came all the load. And before the fifth tribe is there, the tabernacle's back up, wherever they're going to stop. Now, here's the interesting thing about this. Have any of y'all ever run in a marathon? Anybody run in a marathon? Well, let me tell you what's bad about running a 26-mile marathon where everybody's just going to get out there. If you've got 20,000 people in the marathon, if you're on the front headed out, you get to head out right on time. But if you're halfway back, as some of our people in Sagemont have told me that they were halfway back in the 20,000 member pack, it took them 3 minutes of trotting along to get to the starting line. And another 3 minutes for the tail end to get there. We've got over 600,000 men who are soldiers who are moving out, plus all this holy furniture, plus all the women and children. It is a wide swatch. It is a huge swatch. It's moving down. By the time the tail end gets to the camp and sets up, the front part of the camp has been set up and doing business for a long time. And I believe it happened every evening. And I believe that every morning they did their regular sacrifices, and the priests went in and packed everything up, and away they went. Because the Lord being in his holy place was an important thing to them and important to the Lord. So, they start grumbling here in verse 2 because there's no water. They're just grumbling. They're upset. And verse 3 says, "The people thus contended with Moses and spoke, saying, 'If only we had perished when our brothers perished before the Lord.'" Now, let me bring that to you. I wish I had time to go back and show you each of the situations where they complained against Moses 38 years before. When they were there, but I'm going to remind you, every time it was, "Why did you take us out of Egypt to lead us here so that we're going to starve and die right here?" That was the first thing they said. That's not the first thing that this new generation of people is saying. They're saying here, "We remember that we heard the story 38 years ago that whenever you, Moses, you led them someplace, that a lot of our people died. Our brothers died. And in fact, the last time we were here at Kadesh, a lot of our brothers died. A lot of our Israelites died. Wouldn't it have just been better if you're going to bring us to this desolate place? Had we just all died then? So you've taken us back for 38 years, but now here we're back in the same place we were, and are we just going to die?" Look around. There's no place. It is desolate. I mean, it is deserted. You're not going to see running water hardly any place. There's no crops growing. There's no palm trees growing. There's nothing growing. It's nothing but sand. It is parched. It is dry. And they feel like they're going to perish. And I quite frankly believe that for all those who were hoping to go in the promised land, when they ended up back at Kadesh Barnea, they were wondering, "If this is the promised land, I'm not sure I want to go to the promised land, because this is the bottom part of Canaan land, and this is what we're going to get, and the rest of it looks like this. You're trying to tell us this is what our ancestors left Egypt for?" But the ancestors knew about the promised land for all practical purposes. They had seen the goods and things that had come from it up and down the trails and up and down the roads. Verse 4 says, "Why then have you brought the Lord's assembly into this wilderness for us and for our beasts to die here?" They're complaining, they're starving, they're hungry, they're not ready to be there. Verse 5, "Why have you made us come up from Egypt to bring us to this wretched place?" Finally, they get around to the same old complaint, old news, that had happened 38 years before. "It is not a place of grain. It is not a place of figs. It is not a place of vines. It's not a place of pomegranates, nor is there any water to drink." In other words, they're looking around going, "We thought that this was going to have grapes." Remember, they supposed to have grapes in the promised land. They're supposed to have vines in the promised land. We're supposed to have figs and pomegranates. All that stuff was brought back by the spies. Where is it if this is such a great place? "And we're thirsty, Moses." So, Moses comes along. Moses and Aaron left from that assembly, verse 6, the presence of the assembly, at the doorway of the tent of meeting. And the tent of meeting's up. They're there. So that somebody put the thing up. It's the Levites. It's their job. So they go in before the Lord. They fell on their faces and they worshiped. It is the right thing for leaders to do. When you need a decision, go to the Lord and find a decision. Then the glory of the Lord appeared to them. Remember that shining glory? And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, take the rod, and you and your brother Aaron assemble the congregation and speak to the rock before their eyes, that it may yield its water. You shall thus bring forth for them water out of the rock, and let the congregation and their beast drink. So Moses took the rod from before the Lord. Where did he get the rod? From before the Lord. Was it Moses' rod? No, he had his in his hand. That's not the rod that the Lord wanted Moses to use. He wanted him to use the rod that was before the Lord. Which rod was before the Lord? Aaron's rod. The rod that continually had blossom and buds and almonds growing on it. A dead stick, not in soil, not watered or whatever, as a reminder to the people that Aaron was and his lineage was the high priest, and it was totally always blossoming and had almonds on it. And Moses is to take that rod, okay? And Moses and Aaron gathered together the assembly before the rock and said to them, listen now, you rebels. Can you imagine Moses saying to them, listen now, you rebels? You know, there's some words that just emit emotions inside of you when you use them. If I were to call you rebels, it would make you feel really angry. I mean, there are words that just change my whole thinking. And I'm thinking of one right now that just, when I hear that word, it doesn't matter where I am, I start getting saliva out the sides of my mouth. You know what that word is? Close. It's apple fritters. Excuse me. My favorite, apple fritters. I get a smile every time I think about them. Not just everybody's apple fritters, no. Certain company's apple fritters. Just a certain one. I haven't bought one in a year. But I go by and buy their coffee because it's also my favorite coffee. Excuse me. But there are also words that really make you mad. I'm angry right now about a very important couple of words in our America. Two words when they're put together. Free speech just goes all over me now. You see, free speech is a two-edged sword. Free speech says I can say what I want and you can't stop me. Free speech can also say, I can say what I want to say about you when you're talking about free speech. You can come and say anything you want at this auditorium, but I have every right to get out here in the front out here and say what I want to say about what you're saying, what you want to say, because I want to say what I want to say, and I don't agree with what you want to say because you want to say what you want to say, and you don't agree with what I want to say, because I'll say what I want to say, and you say what you want to say, and it doesn't matter. We both got free speech. And both of us may be confused. That is correct. We are confused. That's right. And it just goes all over me. And I don't know why. I've never been angry about free speech. I don't want us to get rid of free speech. I tell you that. But do what? It's a little out of hand. You think so? Turn into something that's not meant to be. Yeah. It just goes. You see how? Okay. There are also other words that just set us off. And I'm sure instead of me taking the time to do that, because there's a bunch of them that are going on out in the world today, Moses uses the word rebel and he set off. He is not happy with them. He says, you rebels, shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock? And then Moses lifted up his hand and he struck the rock twice with his rod. By the word his is not in the original, it's with the rod. And the water came forth abundantly in the congregation and their beast drank. Their animals, they drank. Struck it twice. Now, just a little side note of interest for you. You can go to almost all the commentaries that are out there by all the great theologians of the past, of which I have the most high regard for, and I love them all. And they all try to say that there is something spectacular about the reason why Moses struck the rock twice. And they try to tell you what that means. I don't believe one of them. Do you know why? Because when I was 6 years old, my father taught me how to drive a 10-penny nail with two strikes. I'm young. Now, first of all, the thing he had to do was, you know, a hammer looks like this. The first thing he had to teach me was to take my hand away from up there at the top where that little head is, where you hammer like this. And you get the nail about halfway down, and it's tired of being nailed on, and so it decides to turn over. You know what I'm talking about. And my father had to teach me how to come back on the very end of that handle, almost holding it to where the end was right there, so that I could take a nail, a 10-penny nail, and put it where I wanted to, and just kind of give it one little tap, boom, just to set it. And then you remove your hand and you go, bam, bam, and the 10-penny nail is all the way in. Some of y'all who worked at Danbury, you watched me with my hammer drive those big old long nails in two strikes. I believe that Moses hit that rock twice just because he felt like it. Bam, bam, and that's it. Because it's just natural. It's just natural. Why put some unnatural theological hoopla on something that everybody out here does and hits it twice? Ladies, when you're stirring up that batter, making that whatever, scooping away the last of the batter to put it in the pan, you've got your spatula, and what do? Pap, pap. You got it? We're humans. Interpret the Bible with the natural ways that humans do because we have not changed. Don't make big things out of nothing. Well, they got their water, but they goofed up. Verse 12. But the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, because you have not believed me to treat me as holy in the sight of the sons of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them. What in the world did Aaron do to be associated with the sin of Moses? Search all that you want. We're on page 94. Search all that you want, and you cannot find the reason why Aaron sinned in this instance. He was given instruction by the Lord that he and Moses were to take the rod and to go speak to the rock, and Moses did it. Moses is the one who didn't speak to the rock. He struck the rock. So here's the bottom line for your heart today. If the Lord tells you something to do, do it exactly the way that he tells you to do it. And just remember this. If you're a bystander with someone and they go to strike a rock with your rod that's got almonds on it, and you heard the Lord say, speak to the rock, Moses, speak, don't strike it. Yep. Speak up. Aaron did not, as we know from his character study, he was just kind of a bumbling fool when it came to talking. I mean, remember, 38 years earlier, the earth has opened up. People are falling into the earthquake. Moses is on, and Aaron are on their face, and Moses has to look over to Aaron and say, Aaron, you're the priest. I'm praying. You go get your pan and make the offering. Go. That's your business. While Moses has to say, little brother, I mean, big brother. Little brother. I probably was little, or you never know, but he's the big brother in age. Go do what you've been ordained to do. I can't do it. I'm not ordained to be the priest. You are. Go get those fire pans and put the incense up to make a sweet aroma to the Lord so that the Lord will stop this. And I'm praying that he'll bring it into it. And the Lord closes up that earth and 14,700 people have been swallowed up 38 years before. Aaron just didn't talk very well. I'm not even sure he repeated very well of what the Lord said. But he got implicated in this. Verse 13 says, talking about the waters that came forth, those were the waters of Meribah, because the sons of Israel contended with the Lord, and he proved himself holy among them. I love that verse, that part. He proved himself holy among them. I love it because I have come to realize that even when we as humans do things wrong, and even when we as humans have needs, and when we as humans go to ask God for something, I have come to realize that God has always already done his part. The problem is you did your part without asking him what he wanted done. And he's always, always done his part. The problem is we can't just always recognize it because we've not been in tune with him in on his plan. And sometimes by the time we're on our knees praying for God and begging for him on something, we haven't recognized that God is not going to rubber stamp what we're praying for if it's not his will. But what we have to understand is he's always done his part already for us, and he has never failed, even though we have failed to do our part in the covenant with him. The Lord here, with the children of Israel, did not deserve the water from the rock, but the Lord was faithful to provide no matter what. He always did his part. They called it the waters of Meribah. There in Kadesh. Time out. Back at Mount Horeb. Back there where that rock is that we can identify, that has no source of where water should have come from it. But we have the picture, it's in your notes, where evidently for a long period of time water was gushing forth, but we know not where from. That was the rock that Moses was told to strike 39 years before, almost 40. They called that the waters of Meribah also, because the waters of Meribah means waters of quarreling. So both at Mount Horeb and at Kadesh, there are two places where the waters of quarreling are mentioned. Verse 14. Now from Kadesh, Moses then sent messengers to the king of Edom. And this is what Moses says. Thus your brother Israel has said. Your brother Israel and the king of Edom, brothers? Absolutely, they're brothers. They're brothers 470 years removed. You remember when Jacob was 91 years of age, he came back from Haran, and as he crossed the Jordan River, his brother, his twin brother Esau, 91 years of age, met him, kissed him, and fell on his face before him and loved and adored his deceptive, evil brother whose name was Jacob. Show me something in the book of Genesis that shows you something evil about Esau. Esau was so good that when Jacob settled down his land and all that, he settled it right there where Esau was, just kind of moved in on his brother. And Esau decided, you know what? I think we're going to take all of my marbles and all of my baskets and my footballs and basketballs and all my players, and we're going to go down south of the Dead Sea, and we are going to settle down there. So they leave this area, Esau, Jacob's brother, and move down to this area, Esau is just a different form of the word, Edom is just a different form of the word Esau. They both mean red. One is in relationship to the man Esau himself. The other is relationship to his heritage who came after him, the Edomites or the Esauites, but it's Edomites because they're the descendants of Esau. So when Moses says, your brother Israel, these are cousins, folks. These are cousins. And Moses is saying, hey, you remember us? And I'm sure the Edomites did remember them. And the Lord goes, and Moses goes on to say, you know all the hardships that have befallen us, and that our fathers went down to Egypt, and we stayed in Egypt for a long time. And it's been 470 years, by the way. And the Egyptians treated us with 430 years down there. And the Egyptians treated us and our fathers badly. But when we cried out to the Lord, he heard our voice and sent an angel and brought us out from Egypt. And behold, we are at Kadesh, a town on the edge of your territory. It's been 470 years since they left Egypt. They were in Egypt for 430. They've been in the wilderness for 40. So that's 470. And now we're back on at Kadesh and we're on the end of your territory. And please let us pass through your land, verse 17. We will not pass through the field or through the vineyard. We will not even drink water from a well. We will go along the king's highway, not turning to the right, not turning to the left, until we pass through your territory, king's highway. At the bottom of the page there, I actually have an article out of the 2018 Encyclopedia Britannica that speaks about that King's Highway. Let me just show it to you. It's still there today. It's been there. It was there way before Jacob went into the promised land, went into Egypt 470 years earlier. It's a major trade route that comes on this side, coming down as you come across the Fertile Crescent from the Euphrates River. It comes down on the east side of the Jordan River, goes all the way down through the land of Midian, and passes down, passed through Mount Sinai, goes right through the city that was controlled by Moses' father-in-law, Jethro. This is called the King's Highway. The other trade route is this route that is over here that I told you about. But by the way, when they left Mount Sinai, they came over and picked up the King's Highway. They went up to this point and they picked up another well-worn trade route that went right through Kadesh and went over to this highway. They're traveling out in the open on the best roads that they can travel that are well-traveled. They have stopping points. They have trading posts. They have waters. They have oases. They have things they need. All the way along the way. And so Moses says, brother, can we cross right across your land? We're here in Kadesh. We want to come straight across to the King's Highway, make a jaunt to the north, and away we're going to go. We're not even going to drink out of your well. We're not going to take a grape off of one of your vines. We're just going to get there. We're going to go north because we're going to go up, and we're going to go into the promised land and take our promised land from there. And what does the king of Edom say? Verse 18, Edom, however, said to him, you shall not pass through us, or I will come out with a sword against you, brother against brother. Again, the sons of Israel said to him, tell you what, we will go up by the highway. We're going to go over, we're going to catch the highway, and we're going to go up right through the middle, and we're going up. And if I and my livestock do not drink any of your water, then I will pay its price. You're going to make money out of this. Just let us go through. Let us pass through on my feet, nothing else. But the king of Edom said, you shall not pass through. And Edom came out against him with a heavy force and with a strong hand. And thus Edom refused to allow Israel to pass through his territory. So Israel turned away from him. Now when they set out from Kadesh, the sons of Israel, the whole congregation, came to Mount Hor. In other words, Moses made the choice not to try to fight the king of Edom. Yes, ma'am. They are following the cloud. Well, you have to remember. Remember what I told you a while ago? The Lord is always doing his part, even though we don't do ours. And Moses was trying to help the Lord out. Have you ever tried to help the Lord out? It never ends well, does it? No. Surely the Lord would want this. Yeah. 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 About this time, a person came to my office and told me that the Lord had told him to give all of his retirement fund to a special needs organization. I said, are you sure the Lord told you to do that? Yes, he's going to bless me. I said, you realize you're past the age of being able to recoup that money and earn it. Because remember, you got fired basically because of how old you were and they were cutting down and you had a pretty good retirement fund. I said, well, I'll tell you what, I'm not sure that I can tell you not to do it or to do it. If the Lord told you to do it, you do want to do it. But if the Lord didn't tell you to do it and you heard some other little voice tell you to do it, then it'll be the worst tragedy you ever did in your life. So he went ahead and did it. Yeah. He calls every month because he can't pay his bills. Can't pay his bills. But it was something the Lord wanted him to do. No, it wasn't something the Lord wanted him to do. Not at all. So they turned and left Kadesh and they went to Mount Hor. Mount Hor is a mount. It's a mountain. They're not going back into Edom's land. In fact, let's read the scripture and we'll find out what it says. It says, then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron on the Mount Hor by the border of the land of Edom. So they're on the border of the land of Edom somewhere. And Aaron will be gathered, and he's saying, Aaron will be gathered to his people, for he shall not enter the land which I have given to the sons of Israel. Miriam's already dead, now he's getting rid of his brother. Because you rebelled against my command with the waters at Meribah. Take Aaron and his son Eleazar and take them up to Mount Hor. And strip Aaron of his garments and put them on his son Eleazar. So Aaron will be gathered to his people and will die there. So Moses did as the Lord had commanded, and they went up on Mount Hor in the sight of all the congregation. They know what's going to happen. He's going up alive, and he's not coming back. Oh, can you imagine that stress? Because they're people. And after Moses had stripped Aaron of his garments and put them on his son Eleazar, Eleazar knew what was fixing to happen. Aaron died there on the mountaintop, and we find out that he's buried. Eleazar knew what he was going to perform. Now, this is not the first time Eleazar's had this priestly robes on. He's had Aaron's clothing on before because when Aaron was at rest, Eleazar or Ithamar put on the high priest robes to act as a vicarious high priest, a substitute high priest for Aaron while he's resting. But now Eleazar is the high priest. And his father dies and he doesn't flinch and he becomes the high priest. Verse 28b. Then Moses and Eleazar came down from the mountain when all the congregation saw that Aaron had died. All the house of Israel wept for 30 days. By the way, we're not there yet. Moses has not died yet. But when Moses dies, they are going to mourn for him for 30 days too. So that ends that chapter, but I want to pick up with four more verses before we end. Because we're going to go into another story next week that I wanted to leave it off from this week. Verse 20, chapter 21, verse 1 says, now when the Canaanite, the king of Arad, who lived in the Negev, heard that Israel was coming by the way of Atharim, then he fought against Israel and took some of them captive. Now let me just bring you up on what we're talking about here. Over here in the Negev, there is a king by the name of Arad, of an area, a town called Arad. That king has heard that the Israelites are in the vicinity and they're going to go into the promised land by way of Atharim. Atharim means the way of the spies. So in the last 38 years, the legend had come down to all the Canaanites who now knew that the Israelites were going to come and try to take the Canaanite land as the promised land. They now knew about how the spies had come into Kadesh and gone straight up to Hebron and gone into the valley just past Hebron, collected the grapes and came back out. And they didn't hide themselves from anybody. They were right on the roads snoozing up and getting up next to and to everybody who was there in the land. And that trail that they went became the way of the Atharim. So this king knew that if they're doing the way of the Atharim, he knows where they're coming from and where they're going. So he comes out in the Gev, he goes down to Kadesh, he doesn't find them there. So he finds, keeps on going with them somewhere down before we get to the peak of the Red Sea here. He finds them at Mount Hor somewhere, and it's not hard to find them. You know why it's not hard to find them? This is a lot of people. And believe me, they were not into the modern day thought of camp and leave no sign that you have camped there. You understand? No impact camping? Well, even when I was a Boy Scout, which is just now Scouts, by the way, it's not Boy Scouts, it's Scouts. I have some friends who have girls who are so excited about the Scouts changing their position because they were tired of doing crafts inside. And that's all they wanted to get into the Boy Scouts for, is to go camping. Well, maybe some other things, but camping, okay? Out with the water moccasins and the campfires. When I was doing campfires, we'd cook it down. We'd let it die down. We knew about when we were leaving, let the coals die down. We'd pour water on it. We'd put dirt on it. You could see where the fire was. It was still much smudgy there. It was still a little hot, and we went home. Now, if you make a fire, you have to make sure, and you hide all those ashes, and you make sure they're out, and you go find some place that's inconspicuous and cut up some grass and plant back over it. It's called no impact. You have to resod. This nation of Israel is not resodding anything. Never will forget, Wally Fleming used to sit right here. Lives up in Katy now. He used to drive our buses. When I first came, he was making trips over to Iraq. And one day I said to him, Wally, what is the one thing about Iraq that just shocks you every time you get there? He said, Brother Jim, you know what? Anybody know Wally? He does that. He always moves when he talks. Brother Jim, you know, the airplanes, they don't have tunnels where you get out like we have. You have to get out on the airplane, out on the airport, and you go down the steps and you walk in. He said, they open that door, the sewage smell just fills the airplane. Any of y'all been over there to the Middle East? Anybody there? Is that right? The smell, it's everywhere. It is everywhere. I said, well, how can you stand it? He said, oh, 30 or 40 minutes and you don't even smell it anymore. Yeah. No wonder when we're in Helping Hands and people come in, stink to high heavens, and they don't know they stink. By the way, this would be a great place to jump off in sin and talk about sin, how much sin stinks, and you don't even know it stinks, but I got another verse to go here. Yes, sir. Yeah, it was time to go home. That is exactly right. Well, this king follows that million people trail, catches up with them at Mount Hor, catches up with them and takes some Israelites captive. He doesn't kill them. He takes them captive. Here's what's happened. Let's finish it up. Verse 2 says, so Israel made a vow to the Lord. About time. Let's talk to God about this. And said, Lord, if you will indeed deliver this people into my hands, then I will surely utterly destroy their cities. And the Lord heard the voice of Israel and delivered up the Canaanites. Then they utterly destroyed them and their cities. Thus the name of the place was called Hormah. By the way, Hormah means asylum or a place of utter destruction. And so lo and behold, the Israelites have their first taste where the Lord does the work and completes the battle. They're not even a group of people who know how to fight and they'll win their first battle. They utterly destroy that Canaanite king and his group that came after them. By the way, it's interesting, is after they go into the promised land later on in a year or so, they're going to start dividing up the land, and Simeon's going to get this plot of land that belonged to this king as his tribal area. Verse 4 says, "So then they set out from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom, and the people became impatient because of the journey." So they're somewhere on Mount Hor, somewhere along in here. They head down to the Red Sea. They make it around, and they go around the edge of Edom. The king's highway runs through Edom. They can't take that. They have to get out on the Badlands, where it's rough and rugged and terrible. And they start heading north, and Moses is the one who led them there. They already knew that the Lord would fight for them. They probably want to know why they couldn't head up the king's highway. They want to know why they can't fight the Edomites who wouldn't let them go through. Moses is being unreasonable, and they are impatient with Moses. And you won't believe what's fixing to happen next. Snakes. There's always a snake in the grass. Lord Jesus, we thank you for this time to study your word and to see how you operate and that you are always faithful no matter what. And we're thankful for that. In your name, amen and amen.